WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow night, many public TV stations will air a documentary called The Castro. It tells the story of how a working-class neighborhood in San Francisco was transformed into the most famous gay neighborhood in America. The Castro became a center for gay bars and shops. The residents organized into a gay political and economic force. My guest Peter Stein wrote and directed the documentary. He says The Castro was one of America's great immigrant stories. But these immigrants weren't fleeing persecution in other nations. They were fleeing intolerant families and neighbors. Cleve Jones, who was joining us by phone, is a good example. He moved to San Francisco in the early 70s to escape harassment in his hometown of West Lafayette, Indiana. After moving to the Castro, he worked with Harvey Milk, who was one of the nation's first openly gay elected officials. Jones also originated the AIDS Memorial Quilt. Peter Stein and Cleve Jones had different takes on the early days of the Castro. Peter, you grew up in San Francisco. I think it was for college that you left. You returned as an adult in the 80s, but you never lived in the Castro. In fact, you described the Castro as being too claustrophobic, homogenous, and relentlessly sexualized. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, well, when I was growing up in San Francisco in the 60s and 70s, the Castro wasn't even known as the Castro. It was called Eureka Valley, and it was a pretty nondescript neighborhood. My closest memory of it was that it was a place to transfer the streetcar when I was going to junior high school. By the time I came back, which was the early 80s, it had been utterly transformed. It was a gay mecca, and pretty much 24 hours a day, it was a place where it was go, go, go all the time. And I think for gay people who were first moving here, it probably was extremely exciting to find each other in that neighborhood and to be able to get whatever you need from, if it was just a service that you needed or if it was a sexual service. The fact that it was, as I say, kind of relentlessly oriented toward gay life was, I think, to me, a little bit claustrophobic. And I know many gay people all around the country who come to the Castro and sort of wonder, well, what's the big deal here? What is the importance of the neighborhood? And I think, in a way, it's the history of it, once you get to know it, that actually brings out what is significant about it. But when I first came back to San Francisco, I chose not to live in the Castro. It was a great place to go visit, but I didn't really want to experience it 24 hours a day.
What did you mean when you said it was relentlessly sexualized?
You're going to nail me on that one, aren't you, Terry?
Yeah, I'll try.
I think my feeling was that in all the shops, for example, you couldn't get a gift card for somebody, a birthday card, without being assaulted by a lot of, you know, either soft or hardcore pornographic images. There was a lot of cruising on the street going on, and there was something very titillating and exciting about that. But for me, it just felt that I wouldn't want to choose to be there 24 hours a day.
And I wouldn't have chosen to live anywhere else.
Yeah, Cleve, what did you like, and is there anything you didn't like about living in a gay neighborhood in the Castro?
The only thing I didn't like about it were the straight kids that would come in periodically to beat us up. It certainly was a sexually charged environment. You can't deny that, but it was much more than that. I think for me what was most significant about it was to be in a place where gay people were the majority. That was astonishing to me. And to come there from Phoenix, Arizona in 1972, where you had to enter a gay bar through a back alley, through an unmarked entrance, to come to this place where the gay bars had big open windows right on the street and where the majority of the people that you saw on the street were identifiably gay or lesbian, it gave me a great feeling of security and safety. And, of course, we were out on the street all of the time, but it wasn't just to find sexual partners. It was to meet your neighbors and be friends. And it was quite extraordinary. I found myself never wanting to go home. I just wanted to be out on the sidewalk, putting up posters for the next rally or meeting my friends, exchanging gossip. It was a great time.
Peter, your new documentary looks at how the Castro became a gay neighborhood. Why, of all the neighborhoods in San Francisco, was it the Castro?
Well, a combination of factors really led to the Castro springing forth. It wasn't the first gay neighborhood in San Francisco. The old North Beach section of San Francisco, which was always the bohemian enclave, really marked the first place where gay people knew they could find each other, even as early as the 20s. And later, an area called Polk Street was a place where a lot of clubs and dance clubs and bars were. An interesting set of factors happened to create the Castro. One was that there was just available housing there. A lot of the middle-class families, second and third and fourth generation Irish and Scandinavian families, had moved out by the late 50s and early 60s to pursue the, you know, the great American suburban dream. You also, at the same time, had this tremendous influx of new young residents to San Francisco because in the mid-60s, we had this huge explosion of hippie culture, and that brought a lot of people into the Haight-Ashbury, which is just right over the hill from the Castro. And I think at first, it was just by happenstance that a few gay bars started to open along Castro Street. But very soon, it coincided with a whole movement in America that had gay people not just wanting a place to rent and then go somewhere else to have a bar or to meet folks, but to actually claim a neighborhood as a meeting ground, as a place to have shops and businesses and elect political officials and so forth. And I think the fourth factor that really helped push it over the edge into a true mecca was it ended up having a leader in Harvey Milk. Now that Harvey Milk came in 1973, but within a couple of years he had emerged as, in some ways, the neighborhood champion, and he himself was advocating the neighborhood becoming a true building block for gay power, not just political power, but also economic clout and a place to have a voice.
Peter, one of the interesting things about your documentary is that you interviewed a lot of the people who used to live in the Castro back when it was still called Eureka Valley, when the neighborhood was predominantly comprised of Irish and Scandinavian families. What was the reaction of the people who were still there when more and more gay people started moving into the neighborhood? What was the reaction of these families to the gay newcomers that were coming in and transforming the place?
Well, I must say I went into this documentary assuming that I would hear a lot of resentment of people feeling that their neighborhood was usurped. The fact is, Eureka Valley was a very tight-knit neighborhood for 50, 60 years, and people spoke to me very fondly of their time growing up in this sweet American urban pocket. But I got to say I didn't hear a whole lot of resentment. That may be because the people who really did resent the idea that gay people were moving into the neighborhood had left and left early on. But I think it's more the case that most of the residents of the neighborhood profited enormously by the real estate improvements that happened. I talked with one fellow who had sold the rights to his bar, not even the bar itself, but just the rights to run a bar in the late 60s for $7,000 to what then became a gay bar. He then resold it in 1978 for $700,000. So I think that tends to mollify a certain amount of the resentment that people felt. The other factor, I think, though, is that many, many San Franciscans really did not see the gay community in their midst as a threat. There may have been a sense of, gee, we'd rather not have this so public on our doorsteps. And I did hear from that, and we hear some people in the documentary who felt that the kind of openness was distasteful to them. But for the most part, I think people accepted it as part of the city that they love.
Cleve, you worked with Harvey Milk in organizing the Castro community into a political force. And that community, in turn, elected Harvey Milk as a supervisor in San Francisco. What was your approach to organizing? How do you think it compared to kind of standard political organizing in a neighborhood?
I think that we followed a pretty traditional model of building precinct organizations, but I think we started it a bit differently. It was a time of many crises. There were the votes for the anti-gay referenda, for example, that occurred in Dade County, in Wichita, in St. Paul, in Eugene, Oregon. And one of the ways that we organized people was whenever there was a crisis, no matter where it occurred, whether it was in the Midwest or down in Florida, if gay people were denied their rights somewhere, we would call big, spontaneous marches in the Castro. We got people very energized. For a while, for a couple of years, it seemed like every other week there would be 50,000 people marching up and down Knob Hill blowing whistles. And So we were able to mobilize a lot of people, and there were so many folks that had moved here from towns where it was just unheard of to even consider proclaiming your true identity, and they were very excited and energized. It was sort of the first wave of gay political activism.
What was the impact of Harvey Milk's assassination on you, Cleve Jones, after having worked so closely with him? Were you worried that you'd be killed or another associate of yours would be killed next?
It was very frightening. I'm very close to my mother and father now, but at that time I really didn't have much of a relationship, especially with my father. Harvey was a dad to me. He was a real mentor, encouraged me to go back to school, got me a job working as an intern for college credit in his office. So personally, I was devastated. I had never lost someone before. I had never seen a dead body, even, in my life. And it was very frightening. The fact that the murderer, Dan White, had been a police officer was very, very scary. During that winter, between the murders and the verdict, the police came back into our bars for the first time in years. There was a lot of police harassment on Castro Street. I felt targeted, and then when the verdict came out and the riot occurred, and I was widely blamed for that, I felt very, very threatened. And in fact, that gay pride of 1979, I actually had bodyguards when I was walking in the parade. So it was scary, and I think that up until Harvey's murder, the whole thing had seemed sort of like this grand adventure. And then with Harvey's murder, we suddenly saw just how terrible the consequences were. And I remember people talking about how, of course, Harvey was not our first martyr. We had lost thousands of people to brutal violence, to alcoholism, to suicide. But Harvey was the first public martyr that was shared by this new community, and his death was very important.
Do you think it had a permanent effect on the community?
Oh, absolutely. Even today, 20 years later, the man's name is mentioned constantly in the Castro, constantly referred to, and I think, you know, it would be a mistake to say that Harvey created the Castro. He moved into it after it had already begun. But he certainly represented the community, and his election was an extraordinary victory for us. We tend to call him the first openly gay elected official, and he was not. A woman named Elaine Noble had been elected to the Massachusetts legislature a couple of years prior. But Harvey was our first, the first on the West Coast, and he represented a type of in-your-face populist style that was really brand new for us.
My guests are Peter Stein, director of the new documentary The Castro, which will be shown tomorrow night on public TV, and Cleve Jones, who lived in the Castro for many years. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Stein, director of the new documentary The Castro. Joining us by phone is Cleve Jones, who lived in the Castro for many years and helped organize that gay neighborhood into a political force. Peter Stein, your documentary on the Castro also looks at the impact of AIDS on the neighborhood. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what you think that effect has been.
Oh, well, it's been absolutely enormous. In fact, I think I don't believe I could have done this documentary even 2 or 3 years ago. I think the neighborhood and the people who made the Castro what it was in the 70s and 80s were still reeling from the shock of this epidemic. It's hard to imagine. This is a very small neighborhood. There may be 50 or 60,000 residents in it. By 1990, 10,000 San Franciscans had died of AIDS, and we can't say exactly how many of those were Castro residents, but a great majority were either denizens or certainly knew of and were familiar faces in the Castro. So this is almost incalculable, the loss, not just the sheer numbers, but the political leaders, the shop owners, just the everyday faces on the street. And it really is only in the last couple of years that people have begun to emerge from some of this trauma to look back and see, well, how did we get here? So I think that AIDS created, first of all, a much more sober culture in the neighborhood. A lot of shops did close down. People didn't go out as much at night, and there was that kind of shutting down of some of the exuberant culture that had made the Castro really delightful. There are people in the documentary who describe it as being unbelievably depressing. I'm not sure it was the neighborhood per se that was depressing. It was their lives. People were going to funerals every week.
Cleve, during the height of the AIDS epidemic, when the Castro neighborhood was so hard hit by it, it, for residents like you there, meant that you were just totally surrounded by the impact of the epidemic. You know, the whole neighborhood was hard hit. Did that make the epidemic even more difficult, living in a neighborhood that was constantly registering the impact of it? At that time, did you ever entertain the idea of, like, moving to a neighborhood where you could, like, just mentally have some attempt of getting away from it for a little while?
I did leave for a while in 1985. I went and took a break on Maui just for a year to try and get my emotional strength back. It was very, very difficult because one could walk down the street in September, see a friend looking rather thin, and then 2 weeks later, or in early October, you'd read his name in the obituaries. You saw people walking around. You saw people in the cafes who were obviously very, very close to death. There was this constant visual reminder. So it was impossible to forget, even for a few minutes, what was happening. I mean, Peter was not exaggerating. There were many, many years of my life where close, dear friends died every week. And it was very difficult. But, you know, when I went away, I wanted to hide from it for a while. And Maui's a beautiful place, but every morning I woke up thinking of what was happening back on Castro Street and wondering who was going to be gone by the time I got back. And it became very important for me to go home and keep fighting.
Peter Stein, what's the Castro like now compared to what was in its early days as a gay neighborhood in the 70s?
Well, it's facing a real challenge now because it's become extremely popular and successful as a tourist attraction. And so you've got rainbow flags flying everywhere. You've got a streetcar line that brings tourists and sort of vomits them out at the corner of Castro and Market every hour on the hour. And a lot of the residents and the gay community at large is wondering, is this going to become just another upscale pocket that really has little relationship to the gay community that created it? There's also an element of the Castro that feels a little bit like a gay theme park, where the fact is that like neighborhoods now in Chicago and in Los Angeles and New York, people want to see, quote-unquote, where the gay people live, even though the Castro itself now has become very mixed. There are lots and lots of straight folks and traditional families as well as alternative families. I think the big challenge is going to be, can the neighborhood retain a neighborhood and mixed class feel? Housing prices are just sky high, as are rentals. So, and this is an ongoing problem. Harvey Milk couldn't afford to stay in his camera store in 1978 because the landlord kept raising the rent.
Cleve Jones, you're now living in Palm Springs. Why did you leave the Castro?
I left the Castro in 1992 when I got sick with AIDS, and I thought I was going to die and did not want to die in the city. And I moved out to the country up in the north on the Russian River and lived there for several years until my health began to return. And I've had ongoing lung problems, and my doctor suggested that living in a desert would be better for my health, so that's why I'm down here.
How's your health now?
Excellent now, thank you.
Good, good. And what's the status of the AIDS quilt, which you originated?
Well, you know, I started that in San Francisco, and I had the idea for it on the night that we have the candlelight march for Harvey Milk. I was standing at the corner of Castro and Market and picked up a copy of the Examiner, which said that 1,000 San Franciscans had already been killed by the new epidemic. And I knew that of those 1,000, almost every one of them had lived and died within a few blocks of Castro Street. And I was so frustrated that you couldn't see any evidence of that. The quilt grew rapidly, and only in the last couple of years has the growth of the quilt begun to slow due to the new drug treatments. But it's interesting, as the number of new quilts coming in declines, the number of requests for displays of the quilt around the country and the world have increased. So we're doing major displays of the quilt almost every week somewhere in the country. We're taking the quilt into high schools, trying to educate young people. And now a big challenge for us is that this project, this quilt that came really out of the Castro, and I think the Castro is probably the only place in the world that could have produced this work of art. Now we're really trying to shift to make sure that our message can be heard by young heterosexuals who are now at great risk of contracting HIV. So we're focusing more and more on getting into the high schools with the quilt.
Peter, one of the things that I learned from your documentary on the Castro was that I Left My Heart in San Francisco was actually written by two gay men in the 1950s. What's the story behind the song?
Oh, it's a charming story, and it was something I learned in doing the show as well. It turns out that this songwriting couple, George Corey and Douglas Cross, lived in New York. They were partners in life as well as in their career, and they paid frequent visits to San Francisco in the 50s when, of course, gay life, though very underground, was quite active and exuberant. And they came back to New York and wrote this little Valentine to the city that they had left behind. And it wasn't until about 4 years later that Tony Bennett recorded it. But it's a little piece of subterranean gay history that, that now we're able to shed some light on.
Peter Stein, Cleve Jones, thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you,
Terry.
Peter Stein's documentary, The Castro, will be shown on many public TV stations tomorrow night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.